Good morning, Your Holiness. Thank you. Your Holiness, yesterday at our Mind and Life board meeting, you talked about your aspiration for us to extend our work into many parts of the globe, including Africa. And yesterday, after you had that conversation with us, Dawn Engel emailed Archbishop Tutu, and we've been informed that he will be watching today's events on the live web stream. The work is extending into Africa. Your Holiness, yesterday we began to introduce this topic with Diana Chapman Walsh giving a broad overview and describing addiction as a something that is afflicting individuals, not just in relation to drugs, but also our addiction to material possessions, to oil, to eating, to gambling, many different things. And she also summarized some of the statistics to show how what the magnitude of the problem is today. We then moved on, and I summarized some work that we'll be previewing, that we previewed and will be discussing, including some of the factors which might predispose individuals to addiction. And we talked about the relation between childhood antecedents, like the ability of a child to exercise restraint. And I showed the video of that experiment with children involving marshmallows. And so we thought that today we would do... Now, Your Holiness, would you prefer to have one just now or two in 5 minutes?
If I wait 15 minutes, then any possible
three. Then we moved on, and Mark Lewis gave a very moving presentation, very courageous, and talked about his own struggles with addiction, and also began to introduce some ways that we may conceptualize this in neuroscientific terms. And today we're going to be delving much more deeply into the brain, with an effort to investigate what neuroscience is teaching us about some of the mechanisms that may be involved in addiction, not just to drugs, but more broadly. And Kent Berridge, who will be our speaker this morning, is an extremely well-known neuroscientist at the University of Michigan. He's been a colleague and friend for many years, someone I have deeply respected, and someone whose work I've learned a great deal from. Kent works on this problem because I believe he has a very sincere motivation to have this work benefit those who are afflicted. We are going to be engaging in a journey now to go deep into the brain to understand some of the circuits that are important in this area. And one of Kent's primary contributions, which he'll be talking a lot about today, is the differentiation between liking and wanting and how that is represented in the brain. And so I now will turn it over to Kent.
Thank you, Richie. Thank you for sharing your time with us and allowing us to visit you where you live. I know everyone here today is grateful to be with you, and I am very grateful and glad to be with you today and to have this special dialogue opportunity. I'd like to talk with you about the process of craving and the mechanisms in the brain of craving, with the hope of talking about some surprising features that might be of interest and of use as, Your Holiness, you seek better ways to control craving or escape craving or transform craving into something better. It may be helpful, as you said yesterday, to understand the nature of craving to devise better solutions. It may be helpful to understand the problem to devise better solutions. Yesterday, Rashi Joan Halifax asked the neuroscientists an excellent question, I think, which was, what could we offer that could be useful to an addict or to anyone caught in the grasping of craving to think about craving and devise better ways? And perhaps I should just tell you now in advance the conclusions that I think are emerging from the lab that might be of interest and of use so that you can evaluate them as we talk about the evidence and inform. I look forward to your insights. The conclusions I think that might be emerging from the laboratory studies are surprising perhaps in two ways. One way is what they may be telling us about what craving is not. And the laboratories, I think, may be telling us that while suffering is a route to craving and an initiation that leads to craving often, social suffering leads to craving, or for an addict, withdrawal suffering might lead to craving. The craving itself is not the suffering. The craving is something separate, and it's possible to take away the suffering and still have the craving. And perhaps the usefulness of this is the implication that curing the suffering may not entirely cure the craving, if these laboratory results mean what I think they may. And the other side of this
Yes.
And in the same vein, pleasure and the experience of pleasure is often the trigger for craving and is the object of craving to attain that pleasure again so often. But it may be that pleasure, like suffering, is simply a key that unlocks the lock of craving in the brain to create the craving. But it's the lock being unlocked that creates the craving. The key is only a way to unlock. So I think it's possible to take away the pleasure and still have craving. And it's possible to have a craving even when there's no hope of a future pleasure. So those are features, I think, that may emerge from the evidence of what craving is not, of is not pleasure or suffering itself. But what is craving, the positive feature of craving that may emerge from the laboratory, is that, as Your Holiness said yesterday, without imaginings, there would be no craving. And I think for the laboratory, says, yes, exactly so. Without imaginings and triggers, there would be no craving. But the laboratory may also be saying that to have imaginings create a craving, the brain has a special state which by itself does not produce the craving, but put together with an imagining creates the craving. And that we may see in some of this laboratory evidence. So those are the conclusions, and they may be wrong. I'm probably wrong. But best to see what they may be to better point out what might be right.
Very humble scientist. Mm. Yeah.
So perhaps we can see some things.
The focus. Who's in charge of the... Yeah, okay.
It's not coming up over here.
It's not coming up here either.
Is there... Where is the switch?
I don't know where the switch is. I'm
talking to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I can describe. Mm-hmm. And we can... Shall we move this over?
Yeah, maybe put him on.
Can you do it?
Yeah.
Your Holiness, there's four points I'd like to show you in the laboratory. Four points. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The first point is that one reason craving may be so difficult to control is because it's so robust in the brain, coming from a very deep and large brain system, the dopamine system that Richie Davidson described yesterday and that Mark Lewis described, and we'll say more about that system today. But this wanting craving system in the brain, which I think could be summed up as captured by what Matthieu Ricard has called the grasping quality of cravings. I think the dopamine system is generating this grasping quality of cravings. At low levels, it can be wholesome, but at high levels, narrow, it becomes grasping. Different, entirely different from the grasping quality of desire and wanting in the brain is pleasure-liking, the experience of pleasure-liking, which is captured by these little red dots in the brain. The green system is the large craving system. The little red dots are the pleasure-liking system that can generate intense pleasures. But those pleasure systems are fragile, they're smaller, they're compressed, and they're easily disrupted. So in life, intense pleasures are far more rare than intense desires and cravings. There's two more points I'll show you from the laboratory evidence. The third point is the possibility that craving needs no pleasure object of desire. That it's possible to want even when we do not hope or expect to like. It's possible to want even when the object of desire is known to be disgusting or unpleasant. It's possible to have an intense craving. The brain can do this, and it may be that addicts can do this. Yesterday, Your Holiness mentioned the animal who has food in a trap but avoids the food because the animal knows to reach in the trap would hurt. But it may be that craving can make an animal or a person reach and reach and reach again and be trapped and trapped and trapped again, suffer the pain but still reach, always expecting the pain but still crave and reach. We'll give an example of this in the lab. And the final thing I'd love to show you today from the laboratory is a surprise to me, a puzzle, and perhaps Your Holiness will have insights into how to understand it. It's that this craving brain system that generates such powerful cravings and desires also may generate intense fears. and may be able to generate both desire and fear at the same moment, and may be able to flip between the two, intense fear and desire. It raises the question, what's shared?
So the fear is in relation to the object of craving. Is that what it is?
The fear,
you can have a single-pointed desire or craving to get something, but at the same time you might also have a sense of fear what that would mean.
Concern sharing. Concern.
Sense of concern and those kind of fear. Can you elaborate further?
Concern sharing fear.
So, for example, if there's an element of concern, if that gets heightened, it can turn into fear.
It's a wonderful question, and the answer may be yes. In the laboratory, as it happens, as it shows itself to us, for desire, there's an object of desire found in the world, focused on narrow desire to make wanted, like the marshmallows on the plate. And when fear happens, fear also is attributed to the world, to things around the marshmallows. Can it be attributed to the marshmallow itself, to the object of desire in our laboratory experiments? Maybe so.
So in the Buddhist thought, there's often a discussion in the contemplative.
That Buddhist kismeda. Common sense. Common experience.
So even from a common sense point of view, you know, often we get caught in cycles of anticipations and fear and suspicion. So when you're caught in the cycle of anticipation and kind of doubt, then both the desire and fear elements comes in that experience.
I think here also, I think the awareness, if the person is want something, but at the same time, is that person's mental thinking more wider. So simultaneously, also you see, can feel, oh, there is possibility of such obstacle. So automatically develop, because of that.
Not a hesitation.
Hesitation, Mari. That the gaging the young seeker sabe, yan the tonanda shena.
So sense of concern and also fear. Because in the pursuit of the object of desire, you may run into all sorts of complications. So of course, if you don't have any of those kind of other, apprehensions, and then you just pursue single-pointedly,
I think,
then fear.
I think here maybe you see differences: the human sort of brain sort of activity, sort of work, and animal. I think maybe different.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Animal is just looking there. The human mind, though, look more broader. So possibility of some, because of the difficulties or some obstacles. So that bring fear. I don't know.
It's very helpful. And we'll come up, we'll see the fear in a little bit and come back to that.
But at this point, you're simply stating that they come together, but the fear not necessarily in relation to the same object of desire.
They come together, they may cycle, they may come at the same moment, and when they come at the same moment, they're attributed to things in the world, possibly they could converge at the same thing. I'm not sure. We can
see. 딜레벤 교회선 셰디고.
셰디고. 나는 또 미국 셰디고.
근데 남유는 그 셰디고. 근데 시베 교회에서 요야지다. 레벤 요야지는 배지 시베도 교회요.
So, you know, this description is really based on the activity that is taking place in the brain. And Isolens was saying that from his kind of perspective.
One time we discussed, we touch. You see, the speed.
The speed
of mind.
Yes.
And speed of even light. Mind is much faster from there. There here may be some Buddhist explanation, maybe. In any way, take idea from the Buddhist sort of psychology, and also then you see combined with our own daily experiences. Then I think we can say, so they change brain level much slower. So mental level the fear chigang yonde bichi. That level na sana masala.
So the movement, the activity of the mental processes at the mental level, at the level of mind, is very, very fast. But to be able to detect that at the brain level may not be the case.
Indeed so.
If scientists accept the consciousness is something a little bit sort of separate. Right?
Separate.
So there's still, we need a lot of discussions, a lot of experiments.
I think that even putting that issue aside, the issue that you raise is an extremely interesting one, Your Holiness, just in terms of the differences in the speed of mental events and the speed of brain events. And usually, most neuroscientists would say, I think, and Kent, you can elaborate on this, that the speed of brain events, we can detect activity every on the millisecond level. That's every thousandth of a second. And our experience usually is averaged over at least tens of milliseconds. Most neuroscientists, I think, would say that actually our experience is a temporal integration, an average of brain events, but that we can actually detect brain events that are occurring more quickly than can be resolved in our conscious experience, even for very long-term practitioners who have spent years cultivating their mind.
That's just a
But the level, namju to give a draw and the lap and a second chick to Mutonta Chilton, Charlie, I go to Yoshi. Dot to your sin, the Casa Corralla, Mwea, Tony Shebina, and the Kanda to come to Yamlin test, you the Nieto in that level test, Kasuzu Sheba test, Tangi Sheb, Nibibe, Tatirba, and Tinzuine, Kanda Shebe, namju, Casa Corralla, Mwea, the test, Teva, your sin.
So
here we're conflating the two. One is the point His Holiness is making is not about the processes being conscious to the individual. The consciousness becoming aware to the individual is one thing, but the actual speed of the mental processes themselves.
I see. Okay.
Our experiments are crude in so many ways, and our techniques cannot follow, as Your Holiness points out, the speed of the mental processes. We neuroscientists are proud of our experiments, but they are crude. And we only hope that they can tell us something of interest. I should perhaps show Your Holiness some actual evidence. Yes,
we can get this.
Can we get
that? If you work, okay.
Be much better.
Ah.
Perfect.
Perfect, yeah. So the deep green craving system in the brain, it's a deep system, an old system. The pleasure systems are just little. In my laboratory, many of the experiments that we can do to turn on the brain system can only be done in animals. I'll say a word. As Your Holiness points out, the animal mind is different from the human mind, and the animal brain is different from the human brain. But this deep green craving brain is similar deep inside, and one can find it and see it in both the rat and the human and see the similarities. In my laboratory, our goal is to painlessly turn on brain
systems.
Many of the because a lot of the experiments that has been done and a lot of the discussions that are taking place from the scientific point of view when it comes to desire and craving, they tend to be more on kind of through the sensory modalities, objects of the sensory modalities. But at the same time, there are situations where someone who could reflect upon some kind of an ideal and then feel a very strong sense of kind of connection with that, and then as a result of deep admiration, develop a strong sense of yearning and aspiration for that, which is a kind of a desire. Has there been any experiments done to try and to see the difference between these two types of desire? Because on the sensory modalities level, then humans and animals, there will be a lot of similarities. So when it comes to the mental level of experience, then there will be a difference between the humans and animals. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And it is such a wonderful question. And yet, let me jump ahead. If I can borrow a slide from my friend Richie Davidson, this brain deep system in animals activates to food and drugs and sensory pleasures, and in humans activates to food and drugs and sensory pleasures. But Richie also has shown that in humans, this deep brain system activates to well-being, the sense of well-being in humans who ask and answer. They feel confident and positive about themselves and about the world, a kind of mental aspiration and higher state. The possibility that I would suggest, Richie and I would discuss in who knows what this means, is the activation, the pleasure of feeling confident and power about and positive about themselves? Perhaps. Is it that there's a zest in life in the world and this brain system activates to give that zest in life that goes along with that mental story? Perhaps. Is it something else, a different mental feature that this brain activation produces? Perhaps. But what we all can agree on is that this deep brain system for sensory pleasures in animals and originally for sensory pleasures in us is being recruited to help perhaps produce this higher mental state, a sharing of the brain system, a co-opting of the brain system. That's the hypothesis.
Kasada.
That could be true. Mm. Yeah.
My hope, if that's true, is the sentence in red. That if it's true, then what we can learn in mere laboratory experiments with animals about sensory pleasures may tell us something that's true not only for sensory pleasures in animals and sensory pleasures in people, but possibly also something that's true for wanting and liking in higher states and mental aspirations in people, possibly. That's the hope. Mm. It's a hypothesis. Yeah. So with that in mind, I can show you the evidence. And perhaps the last thing I should mention before we plunge into experiments is that dopamine confuses neuroscientists. We argue about it. We try to solve the problems. Dopamine, as Richie and Mark pointed out, this deep green brain system, it's so often a craving system. It drives the craving. But sometimes dopamine seems to do almost the opposite thing. And tomorrow, Nora Volkow will tell us about
the liver neurochemical dopamine.
Sometimes it almost seems to suppress a craving. Tomorrow, Nora Volkow will tell us about how dopamine might seem to suppress cravings in some addicts. Possibly the solution, there could be a solution to why dopamine does two different things and confuses us. One possible solution is the receptors that receive dopamine. This diagram here is a blow-up of the little circle.
Explain what a receptor is.
Yes, thanks, Richie. Whoops. The little circle where the arrow is not showing up on your screen. The little circle where the arrow is blown up here. And the receptors on neurons that receive the dopamine are like tongues that taste the dopamine. Two different receptors, like two different tongues, two different people tasting something. The D1 dopamine receptor tastes dopamine as something to go, something to create a craving. And Mark and Richie and I talk about the D1, the dopamine creating a craving, often acting on this D1 dopamine receptor. It's as though two people tasted tea. One finds tea sweet, the other finds tea bitter, the same tea. The dopamine receptor tastes, the different receptors taste. They're just molecules, but they taste the dopamine molecule differently.
So can you explain further why the difference between D1 and D2?
Every neuron that receives dopamine has tongues to taste that dopamine.
Some neurons... Dopamine
is a liver nanolia.
Some neurons have two tongues. Some neurons have just a D1 tongue, but other neurons have just a D2. Dopamine is tasted by them all, but the different neurons may do different things with that taste of dopamine. Mostly dopamine causes craving on the D1. We've talked about it yesterday. We'll talk about that today. But sometimes dopamine may stop a craving. It maybe stops a craving. And when that happens, it might be acting on D2.
Suppress. So I mean, talking about brain activation, Solnitz was reminding that often we hear from the scientists that when you experience empathy, there's an element of distress. So the pain, sight of others' pain, seems to be the same as the sight of the pain when you yourself have a suffering.
No.
Yes, that is true. Whether that involves the dopamine system or not, we're not really sure at this point.
So same sort of thing.
No, it's only just making a parallel.
Oh yes, yeah.
I mean, same chemical.
Yes, oh. Exactly.
But mental level different.
Yes. Differently.
Exactly. Yep. So perhaps this is
mind the achievement.
So this is again another suggestion that we need to take mind seriously.
We need to take mind seriously. So that's just to explain why we talk of dopamine as cravings, but tomorrow we may hear a different story. So let's see a craving. Let's actually see a craving. This large brain system that generates this grasping quality of craving, in psychology we call this grasping quality sometimes incentive salience, as Mark described yesterday and Richie. Salience is the noticeability of the object of desire. Incentive salience is the wanting of that object. The object of desire pulls our attention. It pulls us in. It makes us want it. But the wanting essence of this deep brain system is essentially below awareness. When we have conscious desires, this wanting, grasping quality adds that grasping urgency and compellingness and oomph to that want. But this deep brain system can create a want even in the absence of our conscious desire. It can happen in the laboratory, and it may happen sometimes in addiction. It's a deep brain system. There's an interesting question: how can we bring this unconscious deep process better into awareness, or how control it with awareness? So Solens is wondering, given your reference to these unconscious processes, in dream, sometimes you have craving and wanting, as well as anger and so on. So are the brain expressions of these emotions in dream as well as waking states are the same, or...? We would love to know.
There's a little bit of evidence to suggest that at least in humans, there have been experiments where humans sleep in an MRI scanner, not the best place to sleep, but but from those experiments, the same systems that Kent is describing are activated during dreams.
Mm-hmm. 즉 액티브 루당 가서 다 시베 가서 그래 즉 다 롱은 유어 즉 숙청으로 주어 그도 세준이가 비치시 그다다 레벤 유월 때네 어다고 니름 등기 사로 안 레벤 유월 때네 다 안다고 니름 등기 민도시 시도 거
So for example, Solonis is asking this question because now the kind of neuroscience is advanced enough to be able to actually tell by looking at someone who is sleeping whether the person is dreaming or not. Hmm. So there seems to be an ability to distinguish between a waking state of mind of the person and the dream state of mind of the person.
And so deep sleep.
And deep sleep.
Yes, well. that's correct. Yes. That's correct, although...
So this is from the neuroscience point of view, these distinctions are drawn on the basis of looking at the brain.
Correct.
So in that case, how would you explain that the same brain systems are being used in the dream state, which are being used in the waking state?
I mean,
it's our wonderful puzzle.
I mean, but we can say that evolution is very conservative. It uses the same brain systems in many different states. So rather than having a whole separate system, it is much more efficient to use the same system that is used during waking life to represent craving or desires or emotions during dreaming sleep. In fact, just one other point about this. In human sleep, just among random people who've not specifically trained their mind, the most active area during dreaming sleep is an area that's closely related to the regions that Kent is talking about, an area called the amygdala, which Your Holiness knows quite a bit about. It's a critical area for emotion. That's the most active area during dreaming sleep.
So how would you square this statement about the with the another statement that neuroscientists make that when there are brain damage in certain regions of the brain, the functions become over time taken over by other parts of the brain, so which seems to suggest less localization.
There's both, and one of the wonderful qualities of the brain is this capacity for plasticity. So there is certainly some specificity, but there also is. The brain exhibits the capacity to transform itself and to assume functions in certain parts of the brain that were previously carried out in other parts. So both of those are true.
So that means that the mental function that we are trying to infer from the brain activation cannot be attributed to any specific kind of factor within this causation chain, can we?
Absolutely.
Like dopamine.
Absolutely. As Richie says, both are true. There's localizations of function, but they move and they switch. The brain has dopamine for desire, for sensory desires, but it uses for higher aspirations and for dreaming aspirations and perhaps for fear. How can this be true? Richie gives us the best evolutionary answer. A system must be used for more than one thing. How can it be used for more than one thing? We're trying to understand.
And the mushrooms.
But dopamine is generating this desire in its targets, and the essence of this desire is that it has a life of its own. It has this mechanism of dopamine of its own. It can occur in the absence of unpleasantness or in the absence of pleasure. And now I should give you an actual experiment example. Let's do that. If this is true, if this wanting craving can exist all on its own, it has an implication for addiction and for possibly all of us. The implication for addiction is that if wanting can separate from pleasure, wanting in an addict can grow and grow over time. Yes, it can grow and grow over time in an addict who's taking the drug again and again, even if pleasure liking is going down and down. Wanting can grow, and it can grow even if there's no withdrawal, if the addict stops using the drug and is no longer in withdrawal, goes into withdrawal but then goes out of withdrawal. As Mark described, it's relapsing even after months. The wanting system, the craving dopamine system, can rise. The reason it can rise is because the dopamine system is not just activated by drugs and pleasures and imaginings and aspirations, but some things permanently change this dopamine system through neuroplasticity, some things in bad ways. Mark mentioned sensitization. Dopamine sensitization can happen in an addict who takes drugs again and again. Not everyone shows sensitization easily. Some individuals are susceptible. If an individual develops sensitization, the dopamine system becomes more reactive. Not always active, but more reactive, highly reactive to the drug and to drug-related things, or to the object of desire, whatever that person's object of desire is. It creates this intense higher wanting in the absence, even in the absence of pleasure. Richie points out to me that I should explain what sensitization means a little bit better. And what it means is basically neuroplasticity of a bad sort. The neurons become changed. They physically grow more and then more bits that receive information. They become more sensitive. They develop more receptors for neurotransmitters, tongues for the neurotransmitters, so they become stronger, able to create a stronger desire. And once created this change, it can last for years.
So it's like, would you say, turning up the volume control? Is that a useful metaphor?
What an excellent metaphor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's have an actual example of turning on the brain system of desire. And I should say, this is an animal experiment, which we do on two conditions. One condition is to eliminate suffering in the animals, which we can do. All the procedures I'll show you are painless, completely painless. And whenever a surgical operation is required, all the anesthetics and analgesics that we would use for a human surgery are used on the rats. I think I can say that the rats I'll describe you have less suffering in their lives than the average person in this room. in pain and things. But that's just a condition to minimize the suffering as we do the experiment. We hope, we do it in hope that we can find knowledge that will be useful enough and we to justify, to be helpful. And we bear the ethical burden of trying to do these experiments compassionately in this hope. So here's the experiment. This will turn on intense wanting by using a laser in the brain that's painless through a technique that Your Holiness, I think, knows about already, but I'll describe briefly. It's the optogenetic stimulation of the brain. In optogenetic stimulation of the brain, it turns on the brain very, very quickly. And here we're going to turn on the brain painlessly, and we're going to create an addictive desire for one thing in the world, one particular sweet sugar pellet in the world, like the marshmallow on the plate. On your plate, you have a pink marshmallow and a white marshmallow. Suppose the white marshmallow were infinitely more attractive and desirable than the pink. Why should it be? Well, we can make it so.
No,
let's make it so. So this is how the technique works to painlessly activate the brain.
Receptor the fiber. And the fiber the laser ki law. It triggers dopamine,
exactly so. Triggers dopamine. The first step to activate the brain with the laser is to painlessly put a new gene into the brain neurons where the laser will be. This is done under anesthesia while the rat is asleep. A tiny droplet of virus is injected into the brain. The virus carries a gene for a photoreceptor molecule, just like the receptors in our eyes that respond to the light. When light strikes our eyes, a molecule in the eye, a photoreceptor molecule, twists and opens ion gates into the neuron. Ions can excite the neuron. The twisting of the molecule excites the neuron. This painless virus microinjection helps the neurons to make their own photoreceptor molecules. They sprout those photoreceptor molecules. They sprout the eyes on the neuron. And now if light strikes the neuron, the molecule will twist and it will excite the neuron painlessly. Let's apply this to desire. In this experiment, the rat will have two marshmallows. One marshmallow is an ordinary marshmallow.
The experiment purple.
It's a sugar pellet, an ordinary sugar pellet, like the marshmallow.
Yeah.
The other marshmallow is a sugar pellet just like the first, but it will also have the laser activation in the brain that activates the wanting system, the dopamine wanting system. We'll see it now. Let's see it now. Here's the rat. It's utterly painless. It's pressing on this lever to earn a sugar pellet, and you can see the laser on in the brain. The rat is learning about this sugar pellet. It looks for the sugar. Now this other lever comes out. This is ordinary sugar without a laser. The rat presses the lever. It gets a sugar pellet. It wants the sugar. There it gets the sugar pellet. No laser. Let's do that again. Let's tell the rat which lever gets the laser. Here's the choice now. The choice comes out. Both levers come out. And the laser is on. The rat goes only to the laser. Only to the laser lever. It is ignoring this other lever that could earn a sugar pellet. It goes to the laser lever. It stays on the laser lever. It will not leave.
진이게 tablet 만 된 거 있어 봐. 다 개발 가르쳐서는 쇼용 어저 때 레벨급 때 레벨이야 레저 단지 진디게 active 수 쇼예리아 때 제벽급 때 진디게 active 마치 비치 레저 마다 뭐 인자 다 티슈고 진이 지슈고리아 뜨뜨뜨 진이 가완네 베네 진을 하게 올 때 다 레저는 never done the words, Titania Nemjamato, show Yabal than Nemgamanism.
He wants the white marshmallow, he's ignoring the pink marshmallow. He wants the white marshmallow so much that he stays and stays and stays and stays on the white marshmallow.
But the sugar palette are the same.
Identical.
They are the same. They're
identical.
Like two marshmallows.
Okay.
But one, the dopamine system is being turned on for, and the other, it's not.
Yeah. Sure.
The brain stimulation of the laser has created an addictive object of desire, making one marshmallow infinitely preferable over other things. We can see the preference here growing up and up and up. This is just the preference for this one marshmallow, for this one layer, the other is ignored. The manipulation in the brain is very, very painless. I've brought for your holiness to see the actual fiber that goes into the brain. It's very, very thin, like a thread, like a clear plastic thread. I'll pass it to you in a second. First, Richie, my friend Richie, will shine laser light. This laser is a, this remote control is a laser pointer. And there he is. He's shining a bit of laser light. You can see the tip glow. Glow green. There it is.
Yeah.
That's what happens in the brain of the rat. That's all that happens, that the laser light comes through and into the brain, so that this is all that goes into the brain, if your holiness would. And gives the light to the brain. The larger cable you see is just to protect that thin thread. It's just a spring to protect that thin spread. It doesn't go into the brain, so it's all very painless and light. You've seen that it creates this almost addictive like
focus.
Solinus is unconvinced. It's painless, you know.
Let's ask the rat. No, let's ask the rat.
Yes, I do.
Let's ask the rat, we'll jump to this. Let's ask the rat, would he prefer to not have that laser on?
Hmm?
Yeah. Here in this middle graph, we see the rat has a chance. If it touches, there's two objects that poke into the cage. One object pokes here, the other object pokes there. If the rat touches this object, it gets the laser. If the rat touches that, it does not.
Hmm.
If it touches this and it doesn't like the laser, it could avoid it. Yeah. And it, and let's see if it does. What it does is it touches. Then this is the 50% preference line, pure chance. Just try this one, try that one, try that one, try that one. This is the laser bar. It's just above 50%. This is the other object that does not give laser. It's just underneath. They're not actually significantly different in a statistical sense. The rat seems not to care whether the laser is on or off.
Hmm.
It touches this, it touches that, it touches this. It doesn't care. It needs the sugar. It needs the marshmallow in the world. This laser makes that marshmallow in the world an object of intense desire. The laser by itself in the brain, it doesn't matter. It's acting on this trigger. This is this interaction with the outside world. Only the world can become desired, and the brain is meant to do that.
The liking for this, you know, wanting these sugar pellets, it's not a function of just being thirsty.
Let's ask the rat.
You know, to have a sort of an experience of being thirst. Yeah,
yes, it could be. It could be. It could be. Let's ask the rat.
Yep. That's the next experiment. You're so good in anticipating, Your Holiness. Yeah. As I've described, you are the dream graduate student.
Yes, indeed. Yes,
graduate look to professor ki shebe de liye chho tan je professor ki yaar paaye de liye.
It took us months to think of these experiments, and Your Holiness has thought of them in 5 minutes. Which ones to do? Yeah. But let's ask the rat. How would we ask the rat if it's thirsty and if this has changed that its desire and perhaps pleasure for this sugar? We can ask the rat. We can give it sugar water. We can give it sugar water in the mouth and ask if it's thirstier, it will like that sugar water more. How would we know if the rat liked the sugar water more? We can ask the rat similarly to the way a parent, a human parent, asks their newborn baby, does the newborn baby like this taste or that taste or this food? Ask the baby. Ask the rat. Let's try this. We're going to see a short video where a human baby on the first day of life is given a little taste of sugar water, and then we're going to see a rat get the taste of sugar water. Then we're going to see the baby get a taste of bitterness, quinine, and the rat get a taste of bitterness. If a rat is thirsty and it gets the sugar water, it responds as though the sugar water is sweeter, as though it's a sugary, sugary, sugary water. And we'll see there's a difference. Let's see, it'd be clearer. So here's the baby on the first day of life, just a little taste of sugar water. We're seeing it. Look, here's the rat from underneath getting sugar water painlessly into its mouth through a little implanted tube, painlessly, and it's tasting the sweetness. It likes the sweetness. It's licking, it's licking, it's licking its lips. That's what it does to sweetness. And if it were thirsty, it would do more. Here's the baby doing gapes to the bitterness. Bitterness. And the rat to bitterness. Does the baby like the sugar and the rat?
So there's a physical reaction. So someone is asking from the kind of evolutionary point of view, why is it that we like even at this, you know, infancy, the child and the rats, they like the sugary taste and not the bitter taste. Is there evolutionary?
I mean, usually you see the food, you see, I think so that your physical condition, according to your physical condition, sometimes you like certain food or certain taste. And the physical condition change, opposite. So therefore,
so there seems to be some relation to the kind of the basic makeup of the body.
So therefore, that the
sugar.
So
I mean, why is it that there's this kind of revulsion to the bitter taste? I mean, is it because the bitter taste is bad for you, for your body?
Well, usually bitter substances are not good for us. And so there is an innate bias. But it's also true that if the condition of the body changes, the preference for different tastes will change. And Kent will actually show this in yet another experiment.
So that does mean that in the animal world, are there no species that really like prefer bitter taste to sweet taste?
There are very few mammals that prefer bitter taste to sweet taste. Very few. We can learn to like bitterness, but we're born to like sweetness.
Yeah.
So these faces tell us what the brain is born to like. It likes the sweetness. There's fruits in the world that are sweet. The brain seems to know this in advance and is programmed. There are poisons in the world that are bitter. The brain seems to know this in advance. But the pleasure of the taste, as Your Holiness points out, it's not just the taste. It's the body state. Mm-hmm. So if they're thirsty, water will be more liked. Mm-hmm. If they're hungry, sugar will be more liked. If they're ill, nothing will be liked. Mm-hmm. If we activate the brain in pleasure systems of the brain, we can increase liking. If we activate a pleasure system in the brain, we can increase the taste liking. If we hurt the pleasure system in the brain, everything becomes bitter. So does the laser make the rat thirsty? Does the laser that makes the rat want that marshmallow help it to like that marshmallow more because it's thirsty or because it's just making the marshmallow nicer? We can ask the rat. And when we ask the rat, it answers no. It's not thirstier. The marshmallow tastes no better. The sugar pellet tastes no better if we give it the sugar water during the laser. Here we're seeing these liking reactions to a sugar water coming into the mouth. And sometimes the laser is on, and sometimes the laser is off, and there's no difference at all. The laser doesn't make the rat like the sugar more. It only makes it want the sugar more. The laser isn't pleasure by itself. The rat won't work for it. But the laser isn't suffering by itself. The rat doesn't care. The laser simply makes that marshmallow that's been paired with the laser infinitely more attractive. And this is something that can happen in addiction, and it may be something that happens in all of our lives when something becomes craving. This brain system makes that wanted. So that's an example. This can happen in humans too. It's not just an animal experiment. Lasers haven't been used yet in human brains. They will be soon. But deep brain stimulation, of course, electrode stimulations have been done in humans. And sometimes what happens looks almost like the rat. Let me show you just two examples quickly, Your Holiness. This is a case where a woman had a deep brain electrode. And when this electrode was first implanted and turned on in the operating room, she was awake.
Why it was implanted.
She was implanted for a neurological condition. The deep brain electrodes are implanted sometimes for depression, sometimes for obsessive compulsive disorders, sometimes for movement disorders.
Actually, Solens was shown a video of
Helen Mayberg. Your Holiness met Helen Mayberg. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
At Emory.
Exactly.
In D.C., yeah.
When this electrode was turned on first in the operating room, she was conscious. She had local anesthetics. It didn't hurt, but they turn it on to see what's happening in her brain. Are they in the right place? It turns on, and at that moment, the world becomes much more inviting. Her mood became euphoric, and her speech was suddenly more rapid. Her thought was easily distracted, and flights of ideas appeared. There's cognitive mental changes. But here's what's most interesting. At that moment, she loses her social inhibition, and doctors, neurologists, who just happened to be in the operating room, she falls in love with two neurologists who just happened to be standing there. And she tried to embrace and kiss people. Everybody is more interesting and attractive. The world is more interesting and attractive. It's positive. It's euphoric, described. It's a pleasant sort of thing, but not necessarily this wanting. Because later, this electrode stayed on for her to help her. And later, the electrode, the focus narrows of this wanting. For her, it became shopping. She went into unrestrained buying of clothes with her credit card, spending all of her money. And she spent so much money that her family became alarmed and they tried to take her credit card away to help prevent her to help her. But she was frustrated and tense at that moment, and she had suspicious, hostile delusions that her sons were taking her money by force. She was angry, but she still has this desire. The desire doesn't care whether she's happy or whether she's angry and tense. The desire, the craving is there. It has its life of its own. And that's, I think, the important point. One last example of these kinds of desires being turned on. This is a completely different brain study, this one done in Germany, done like Helen Mayville's for depression. When this electrode was turned on, there were no, this is a quote from the paper, there were no pleasure liking effects. There were no liking effects during stimulation, in contrast to previous claims that these electrodes cause pleasure. It's not pleasure liking. But there's a wanting that's coming on, and here's the quote again. Immediately after switching this electrode stimulation on, one man in Germany, he spontaneously reported that he realized he's in the city of Cologne, Germany, and that he has never visited the famous Cologne Cathedral, and that he plans on doing this exactly the next day, now with the electrode on. And indeed, he did that the next day. A second woman who has her electrode turned on, at that moment, she spontaneously mentions that she wishes to take up the pastime of bowling again. It's something she used to do 12 years ago. She hasn't done it since. But now, at this moment, with These are imaginings. Your Holiness mentioned that without imaginings, there's no craving. For each person, they have their own. Each has their own imagining, a cathedral, a pastime that we haven't done. It's not the imaginings by itself, though, and it's not the electrode by itself. The electrode needs the imaginings, and the imagining, the bowling imagining, was there for 12 years, but the electrode makes it suddenly wanted now. That's how this works, I think. So all of that has been about desire. All of that was producing wants for desires without any necessary pleasure. There are pleasure causes in the brain, and I'll just say one brief thing about them. I love to talk about pleasure generators in the brain, but I don't want to bore your holiness, and today's focus is on desire and craving. So just a brief mention to say there are causes of pleasure. We can turn them on, and we can make things more liked. We can make the rat like sugar more, by activating the red spots in the brain. Here's two here in the first diagram, and we've just blown them up here to show you the individual excitations, the stimulations. Wherever you see a red dot, it's increasing, it's multiplying the pleasure-liking reactions to the sweetness, doubling, tripling the pleasure, often more than four times the amount of the natural pleasure when we activate it. Those hot
spots.
No, they get it. They get torn down. They get the.
What's that?
Road nyambe.
No, what is it? What is it?
What is road nyambe? Called kinanjor, ba. Just out of curiosity, how do you measure the doubling and tripling of the pleasure?
So it would be like.
No, and that. Yeah. Could that? Because what do you? How do you choose? Could kinanjor shushar jajor. To do kadi shite minu kajido.
So what would happen, for example, like by kind of activating the pleasure centers and then intensifying the experience of that pleasure, and at that
the double triple stuff.
So you talked about doubling and tripling. So at that immediately after, if you give a bitter taste, what would happen?
It makes the bitterness much less bad.
Oh, chazaga. That's some knowledge. Did you throw a shot? Much.
Laril.
Then you're not any. Laril.
It's such a significant question you ask. How do we know that the pleasure is liking? What do we measure? And all we can measure, we can only, your Holiness puts your finger upon the weakness of our approach. We can only know what we can see. And what we can see are these liking reactions. So we can turn on the laser and we can make the sweetness as though it were more sweet, more liking reactions. At its best, we might make the bitter taste no longer bitter, and at its best, become responded to as sweet when the laser is on, when the brain activation is on. That would be the most potent thing that we could see.
And this is inferred from facial expressions.
That's right, from the video you saw.
It's the intensity of the reaction. Is that how it's judged?
Exactly that. So you imagine the baby face you saw.
전 루식이 그린 용어야 돼.
난도 코드티 쉐베 간데 시접도 요마 다 코드티 류그 나 남규부터 안
되더라고
제가 그 남규편에 아무 제베나 그 가부여베 초 땡글 남규 땡글로 다다는 디에니 레벨이야 디 액티베이션 지원도 갈라 레벨체다 데 남 그서 내급치 내치다 버질 디치도 갈라니 제야 찍고 있네 고 가베 남규도 되고 류그 남규도 숙치로 요버지 다디엔자 아니 커디 제베나 고 간다 지금 몇대와 숙심은 뭐예요? 남바마든 뭐예나? 대주고 카디디 시랑 카디 연금해 보시 땅군중을 연금해 보시는 군주
전체.
그래서 그 류그 남주 고라랑 돈.
그래서 남.
If we imagine the human baby we saw, who was tasting bitterness, and looking so unhappy, and if that baby could suddenly at that moment respond to it as though sweetness, as though the bitterness became sweet and liked, that would be. Similar to what we could see with mm-hmm. the rat. But pleasure is not about addiction. Sorry, addiction is not about pleasure, and the craving is not about pleasure. This liking system is fragile. To turn on to make pleasure more strong, we can turn on a brain spot, and it makes the other spots come on together. The whole liking red system comes on together, and it needs to come on together to create intense pleasure. But it's easily disrupted. Turn on one and suppress the other, there's no more pleasure. And in real life, it's easily disrupted, I think, which may be why intense pleasures for all of us are rare. Intense cravings are common and easy. Intense pleasures are rare. And addiction is not about the pleasure, even when it's a pleasure we seek.
Do you get Because the Tibet thought to go to the Nemushi Nyangum show at Debe, Debalangum show Mato. The Kandaji Kinalangum show with the Mariskinans in the Jurumunes, your Maros Lam. The Debat the set of shoes in it.
When I say that addiction might not be about the pleasure, even when it's pleasure we might seek, I should give an example. Addiction and wanting is not about a pleasure. And perhaps the best example I could give is if it's possible to want something which has never given pleasure, which has always been disgusting, which we know has always been disgusting, and we must expect to be disgusting in the future because it has always been disgusting in the past. Can we want that? Yes, we can. And I can show you how we can make that. And perhaps in some people it's wanted also. To do this, I need an experiment. We need an experiment. And in this experiment, we're going to take something which is naturally disliked.
And
A simple experiment. We just want to take something and make it disliked. If it's below the line here, it means disliked. If it were here, or it'd be wanted. If something is nasty, we learn it's nasty. We learn again it's nasty a second time. A third time, we know and we really learned that it's nasty. The rat will learn this. In this case, the nastiness that the rat will learn about is, it's not terrible. It's just, it's like bitterness, but it's this time very, very salty saltiness. Like being in the ocean and opening our mouth and swallowing seawater. It's not very nice. But suppose we were in the Dead Sea. in the Dead Sea, which is three times saltier than the ocean. And we opened our mouth and swallowed a mouthful of the Dead Sea. It's very, very not nice. That's what the rat is getting a taste of again and again and again. And it will learn to avoid that taste. So it will. We're going to separate its learning and expectations from its wanting here. It'll learn that it's bad and bad and bad and bad and bad. Until one day, the rat suddenly wakes up in a new state, like thirst, but it's a new state that the rat has never been in its life, and you and I have never been in our lives. It's a state of sodium appetite, of sodium deficiency, which our ancestors were in, and squirrels running around may be in, because they don't have enough salt. But all of us have had enough salt all our lives, and the rat has always had enough salt all its life. It's never been in a salt appetite state. But today it wakes up in a salt appetite state because last night it got a drug that can mimic, that tricks the brain into thinking it's in a salt appetite state. So it wakes up in a salt appetite. If it tasted seawater now, it might like it. The rat will taste seawater later on this day. But the question is, when the rat first encounters the sight of something with seawater, the sight that's always been nasty and always been repulsive, what should the rat do? What will the rat do? It's learned that it's always bad. What is it possible to want what we've learned that's always bad? Here's the experiment actually. There'll be two things so we have a contrast. The first thing will be nice to give a positive contrast. It'll be a sweet taste, which is always preceded by a trigger, by a cue, a sign that sweetness will come. The sign is a lever pokes out of the wall. Let's say a lever pokes out of this wall. And when that lever pokes out, it tells the rat sweetness will come. It'll get a squirt of sugar water in its mouth. And it likes that, and it runs over to that lever whenever it sees it, and it hears a sound. A lever pokes out of that wall, a different lever, out of that wall, and it means Dead Sea saltiness will come into the mouth. The rat learns to avoid the Dead Sea saltiness. It doesn't like it. But now one day it wakes up in this new state, and the levers poke out of the wall before, with no sweetness or saltiness. What will the rat do? Is it possible to want what has always been disgusting? And here's what we see. This is the wrong movie. We have the wrong movie, but we can imagine the right movie. So here's what will happen in the right movie. In the right movie, the proper movie, this lever would pop out of the wall and be sugar. This lever would pop out and be saltiness. The rat would learn to always avoid this lever. But what happens on the day the rat wakes up in the new state is it jumps on the saltiness lever just as though it were the sweetness lever. It jumps on the saltiness lever before it's ever...
Isn't that because for the simple reason that it is deficient in salt and needs it?
Absolutely so. Your Holiness is absolutely right. But how does it know? We all need something for happiness. What do we need? Perhaps Your Holiness knows. Many of us search.
But usually happiness when
But I mean, it's
for survival.
It's more of a survival kind of mechanism, isn't it?
It absolutely
rather than happiness.
Is. It, yes, yes. We are. In the laboratory, we're using that natural appetite to create a sudden desire for what is known to be have always been bad. If the rat had one, if a human wakes up in this new state, what happens? It's been done. When a human wakes up in this new state, they feel not very good, but they don't know what they want. If you gave them salt, they'd say, "This is nicer." If you ask a rat in a similar situation where it has no trigger, no concrete cue, it doesn't know what it wants. But if it has this concrete cue for saltiness, it jumps on it.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that without this kind of association being made between the liver and the salty water, the rat doesn't know that it needs salt?
Exactly so. If it tasted salt, it would like
it.
In some sense, the rat is being very realistic because he has a choice and he's taking the choice.
He's being very realistic, yes, yes. And in this case, he's a smart rat.
Yep.
But the same thing may happen in the brain of an addict. Not the same thing, not the salt appetite. But the salt appetite activates the dopamine system when that cue comes, when the smart rat sees that reasonable thing. In the addict may know the drug has not been so good. Mark described there was a moment when he hated taking the drug, and he knew it was ruining his life, and it was like reaching into the trap. And yet, the cues, when the imaginings of the concrete act of taking the drug and the things around taking the drug, it's possible to want that, even when nothing is going to be like. And when that happens, we think, in the brain of someone who's an addict or someone who's simply having an intense craving, it's basically the same as what's happening here in the brain of the rat. This rat's brain is activating. It's not quite as elegant as Richie Davidson's elevating. Sorry. Here we are. The brain is activating only in the moment of simultaneous cue, the lever comes out for salt, and the new state. If the rat were in the new state itself, the brain doesn't activate, and it doesn't know what to do. If the cue comes out ordinarily in the normal state, the rat's afraid of that, and the brain doesn't activate this way. But put this state and the cue together, and there's this magic dopamine activation. Whenever the magic dopamine activation happens, I think the intense craving happens, and addiction is just a different route to that magic dopamine activation.
내가 대화를 들으셨거나 즉 통마다 기난 도제 담아니 답을 제변에 남시 질이 레버코랑 주어 대제 담아니다 템베가리아 기난 용거 매네 매버 신기 신기레 다 되버다 세베 세 토부시 레베인자 아니 코슈군 중년으로지 다 디 용도도스 다 단데 디 지지디 배고 배게지레 So am I right in summing up? The point you're trying to make is that, the experiment on the rat seems to suggest what's happening in the addict brain is that although they may have negative memories of the use of that substance, because the wanting and craving system is so heightened and habituated, it has changed the brain that they continue to do it even though they know that it doesn't give pleasure.
Exactly. So that's so much better than I described. It's exactly what I described.
So that did me do it. But I'm going to answer. Some little honey, shiver tonne, telling you me tombini, Lubu Korechane, yeah, Casu, Doyaj,
Larin,
Yungor, Tabana, the Yada, Comdig into the Taggy. 그는 여자 집에다가 수고 많이 온 데서 자서 놓고 수고 거고 거기 들지. 시멘트 뭐 맞지 그치? 류그그 터네.
So I'm listening to the story of the addict. Solins was saying that even though an addict may be conscious of the negative consequences of that behavior, but
now here mentally already know this is something harmful. Mm-hmm. But now physical, because of much use. So, for temporary physical need that.
So there seems to be a sort of disconnect between what the body is craving and wanting, and then the mental consciousness of the negative consequences of that.
I heard that there are some cases, you see, So
it's only heard of withdrawal symptoms of people who are alcoholic. If they abruptly stop drinking, they start having negative physical reactions. So it seems that needs to be done something in a gradual way. So because the body craves for it, body needs it.
At least for temporary.
Indeed so. As Diana, I'm sure, could describe for alcoholic, can actually be fatal, that withdrawal.
But I think, Your Holiness, you pointed to something which I think is extremely important, but more general. The notion that we cognitively could know something is bad for us, and yet our actions are contrary to that. We continue to do that, or the reverse. We know that something is good for us, but we can't seem to bring ourselves to do it. And so there is often a disparity, a dissociation between our cognitive understanding and the embodied experience.
It's exactly the reason.
Given that this optogenetic procedure you claim to be painless, has it been done on other animals like cats or even birds? Can it be done on these other animals?
Indeed, it can and is being done on a number of animals.
Same reaction?
Same, so it's the response is the same. What you find is the same, yeah.
I think if the same manipulation is done, I think the same reaction will follow. It will be done in humans. We will know that it's painless when it's done in humans. Just like deep brain stimulation electrodes are done.
Yeah. Within the next few years.
Deep brain stimulation.
Insect, yeah.
What about insects?
So, sweet water,
yes,
and has a good
salt, bitter,
bitter water. You can easily examine. He's flying. Come, let them on sweet water, on has a good
bitter,
bitter water.
It's
I don't know.
Maybe we can make the mosquito change their preference.
So still, you see, my question, you see, I never got the answer from scientists. The brain size, from which size have the ability to show appreciation? The mosquito seems to see not that ability.
I think that's probably true.
So since many years, I asked you this question. So far, I think at least 20 years, I think more than 20 years, no one answered that.
We're working on it.
Then my request to the scientist, please plant something in mosquito's mind, the ability to show appreciation. If someone, you see, give blood or voluntarily, then they must show appreciation. Then the donor, blood donor, feel happy. Oh, even tiny. Show affection. Then more willingness, give more blood.
It will be our next experiment.
Good.
The only point I'd like to say before we leave this is the reason why I think that craving doesn't need an object of desire as a pleasure memory or a pleasure hope. It's possible to desire what has always been bad because the craving mechanism has that capacity. And that's an important, perhaps, feature of understanding the craving mechanism.
The problem here is craving is a psychological term.
Yes.
So, it's difficult to, because from a psychological point of view, understanding of craving
Pena kunlum ikse me habchen. Pena adinga de nagus tu zane. Ko tu orme de gel tu slever. Nare. Kunlum ka me bate. Nare.
So for example,
for action so shtoga. Soa de nin yongoro, shibe nin goro. Nare. Tene dus movement chadi. Mixe kunlum ke shamaso. Ko tu so tu yonde shi.
So for example, when you have reflex movements, like Solens was just giving the example of him scratching his nose, you know, he wasn't even consciously kind of, there was no intention, and you just reach out. But the experience is felt.
We think this mechanism can also occur unconsciously, just like scratching. But when it is allowed to pervade consciousness, it helps give the compelling, grasping urgency to the desire.
So for example, like you know, when you're sleeping, you know, you shift your postures, and then there's a kind of blinking of eye movements. There is no conscious intention on the part of the person. So how would that be explained from the kind of brain perspective?
In terms of the blinking?
Blinking and, you know, shifting of the posture.
I think in the brain there's layers and layers and layers. And many of the lower layers are doing their own blinking and shifting of posture automatically. And sometimes a higher level can notice, but it doesn't have to. And it's that relationship that's important.
Well, often there are many of the automatic behaviors that we emit are not conscious, because I believe that evolution has protected us. Because if we had to intentionally breathe with each breath cycle, the species would be over. We'd be finished. Those are the kind of behaviors that are protected. So they just go on automatically. We can become aware of them, but we have limited ability to influence them.
True.
Since Your Holiness has already helped us with the notion of fear and desire, perhaps we could just touch on it. We don't have to dwell, and then we could stop. And I'll just give, it's to me a puzzle that the same brain system for desire might also generate fears. It's this target of dopamine, this striatum target of dopamine. And what we'll see very quickly is simply that turning this same brain system on with different spots of a painless drug microinjection might produce desire. Here's the brain structure again. And here we've blown it up. It's a sideways brain. We've blown it up. Each green dot you see is a painless drug microinjection that's turning on intense desire, just like the laser. The rats, if food is more, they eat much more. They will go back to the place to get that microinjection again. They want it. They prefer it. They may even show liking reactions. If we do the same brain microinjections in the back of this brain structure, the same brain microinjection, we start to get desire mixed with fear, with fear. Our rats are tame. They're friendly. We're always nice to them. They come into the lab before an experiment, and we give them marshmallows or chocolates or M&Ms. The rats climb on the students, and they become friendly. We are a reward laboratory. But sometimes the rats will behave as though they're afraid of us if they've had a yellow or red microinjection. If they've had a yellow microinjection, if we try to touch them, they'll squeal and they'll bite us, so we don't touch them after that microinjection. But even if we don't touch them after that microinjection, they act afraid. They treat us as though we were a nasty, nasty predator, like this rattlesnake. rattlesnake, here's a ground squirrel's view of a rattlesnake, and here's what the ground squirrel does. If a rattlesnake comes to its burrow and tries to eat the pups of the ground squirrel, the rattlesnake does this. It behaves afraid. It defends against the rattlesnake who's approaching. This ground squirrel sees the rattlesnake coming, and it kicks the sand towards the rattlesnake's face. There's the rattlesnake. There. And the ground squirrel defends. And her sisters may come and help also. And they defend the pups in the burrow against the
rattlesnake.
After, and here's her sister coming to do the same. These, you can imagine the state of mind of the ground squirrel facing this predator rattlesnake. In the laboratory, our rats will do that to us. If they're in the cage and we're here, they will kick the sand towards us out here after they've had that yellow or red micro-injection. But the important thing, the only thing I wanted to mention to Your Holiness, is that the brain structure can flip back and forth between desire and dread. And here's the demonstration of that. We just do those micro-injections again, but we do them three times. In three different situations, it's context that controls.
And the drugs that cause what?
No,
drug quite familiar. Drugs that what?
The kind of which dimension? So the dark here means the less lit.
Less. That's right. The dark means the rat's home.
Which
the rat lives.
Which they prefer.
They prefer.
Prefer home.
Yeah. The rats in our laboratory, they live in a quiet, dark room. And it's comfortable to them. And they prefer that, as Richie says. Or we do the micro-injections in the regular lab, which is like this room. Or we do it in the regular lab, but we turn the lights up higher. And we play... Oops. Volume.
Is it a gash or something?
So we play that to the rats. The rats don't like that. I don't like that. The rats don't like that.
Seems universal.
Yeah. How do we know the rats don't like that? We ask the rats. If we ask the rats, they'd learn to turn. If the rats learns that if it goes here, it turns on the music and the lights, the rat never goes there. It goes, it stays here. So it learns to turn off the music.
You don't see them.
They don't see them. Let's go to the next one.
Sorry. If the rat goes here, it would turn on the music. So the rat learns not to go there. If it's in the course of an hour, it learns to turn off the music, Iggy Pop, and it turns on the regular lab. But if we ask the rat about home, it turns off the regular lab and it turns on home, if this were a home place. So the rat...
Home's on drugs.
Dark and quiet.
But
what if the rats cannot choose? What if we just do the micro-injection and then put the rats at home or in the lab or in Iggy Pop? Here's what happens. In the regular lab, you see desire and fear and mixtures of both together in the same as before, front to back. But at home, converts most of this structure into an intense desire. And the music and bright lights converts makes the fear zone expand. Sometimes it's just from fear to mixture or mixture to desire, a slow switch. But some spots you can see, like this spot right here, is pure fear in the music. But move that spot over to here or here and it becomes pure desire. It can flip. The context and situations retunes what the brain generates. And the brain flips. This is a puzzle to us, how the same brain system can do opposite emotions. What is shared psychologically between desire and fear? Perhaps it's less of a puzzle to Your Holiness, but I would love to know your reactions. So I should stop and simply, should I stop and say, and simply say all I've tried to draw are these four conclusions. The first, that wanting and grasping is a problem because it's such an intense system of its own. Individuals are different in their vulnerability to this, but all of us have the capacity for this grasping, wanting system. The system can occur without distress or need, and so perhaps relieving distress and suffering by itself may not eliminate the addictive grasping or craving.
그래서
And the wanting can occur without pleasure as a trigger or as the object of hope. And the surprising thing that wanting has something in common with fear that we don't feel subjectively, many of us, but is the brain is telling us it has something in common. All kinds of questions arise. What is shared between desire and fear? Can your holiness see ways to bring unconscious wanting better into awareness or control? I would love to know your holiness's insights. Thank you.
단디 드리자 단디 되바다 증나님부터 오늘한 전다 emotion 다 되려봐 다 되려 되려봐 나 자세 찍을 돈에 군인이 뭐 이런 것도 될때 되바다 증나님 부를 되바 조금 주셔서 대간다 주요나 한스 직제 아니 간다 즉 롤은 것도 뭐 주부터는 세바단 되바 계획도 없어 대체 지성 공무원도 교회 답신 가려나 한스 강사 고란 아니 뒤인자 아니 세바배 새 토부터도 유나 대체 가야리야 전부 된제
So, thank you, Kent, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Holiness, one question that arises from this, that there are many, but we would very much appreciate hearing your perspective on this, is that Kent's work shows that wanting and liking can be taken apart, and we can want things without liking them, and we can want things even if this wanting can be very intense, even if there's no suffering involved. We can still have this pattern, cyclic pattern of wanting. I wonder if you can, Your Holiness, perhaps tell us from the Buddhist perspective, from the Buddhist tradition, about antidotes to wanting that may be able to be incorporated in a secular kind of curriculum that can help to address this, because it seems like the systems that Kent is talking about that are associated with wanting are so important for addictive behavior of all kinds.
The problem with the word wanting is that wanting need not necessarily be destructive. Because yesterday we talked about how, you know, wanting can take the form of aspiration.
Happiness is the satisfaction. Of course, my sort of understanding the real exact meaning of English and these words. They're very limited. But it seems to say, Deva Tang Tong Lang Slamna, Tachi Digi Kesgamarva, Kurkova Jumzen Tong, Tanglingor.
For example, in the case of wanting something and embracing it out of desire, it need not necessarily be motivated by a kind of a seeking pleasure.
But you seek
something.
So this is not craving, because you seek something because you see its benefits. And because of the out of that, the motivation arises to want it and desire it. So it need not necessarily be linked with pleasure.
Yeah.
So from the Buddhist, if we are to correlate this to Buddhism, then of course we have to bring into account, bring into consideration the different levels of suffering. So you have the evident suffering, which is the conventional suffering. Then you have suffering of change and so on. Yes. So in all of this, His Holiness was saying that...
I think we have to make distinction. Sensory level experience and mental level experiences. The mental experiences also is a spontaneous sort of experience and experience through training. So that also is much depend on awareness.
Awareness, no.
And then yesterday also touched the ignorance, right? Ignorance is two levels. One level of ignorance is simply, if you do not know, the consequences.
Cause and effect and consequences.
Then another level of ignorance, I think much deeper. I think you briefly mentioned, you see, those according to theistic religion, you see, the ones, you see, person, believer, you see, realize or accept our Creator, God, infinite love. All these negative thing, destructive thing, actually not created directly by God, but was out of Khasajukti.
Free will, right?
Free will. So, without knowing that, and
so
the Khasajukti.
So from a theistic point of view, without knowing that deeper reality, then we engaged as if, acting out of free will, creating our own suffering.
So deeper level of ignorance, I think, according to different sort of philosophical views, the Buddhists say, the denzi.
So from the Buddhist point of view, the deeper level of experience really pertains to a distorted way of understanding the world by grasping onto some kind of intrinsic existence.
Oh. So,
of course, within Buddhism, there are different perspectives.
And some of my Christian friend even used to say, since we created by God, so like Buddhist sort of concept, we all have some kind of part of God. God is something there. So Buddhists say Buddha nature. So once know that, then you see you can easily face some problems in challenge. Clear. So that in that deeper level of
so this
ignorance.
Is a deeper level now.
So in secular that
so these of course are not relevant in the context of a secular ethics discourse.
So I think the awareness through education, through awareness. I think yesterday you mentioned, even because of the animal, mouse,
I think one of the speakers yesterday talked about how
I think you.
Even rats, they're addicted to alcohol. If there's a social support network, then they stop drinking. Morphine.
Mm-hmm. So this shows how much affection is effect. Mm-hmm. Remain surrounding same sort of the species, not fighting. peacefully remain. Then give some sort of satisfaction, not much sort of anxiety or these things. Then no need because of that taking
the
these things. Lonely, red, little uncomfortable. So then he tried to seek some kind of comfort from external means. So through training, through awareness, one should develop certain kind of sort of inner, what is it, kasoda. I think
kasoda. Security.
Kasoda. I mean inner value. Then that automatically brings self-confidence, much less fear. Then automatically less desire to seek something from outside. You already have full sort of self-confidence.
Confident.
So those social animals, with among sort of other kasoda, friends or
friends.
Groups, can feel safe, isn't it? So sometimes we very much, very, very clever. We are a social animal, yet you see, our thinking is just oneself, not depend on other. That creates fear, suspicion, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I always telling people, when I meet people, if I stress myself, oh, I'm something special, like His Holiness 14th Dalai Lama. Oh. Then, you see, that automatically, you see, creates some kind of barrier. Actually, you see, that way of thinking, you see, make myself prisoner. Isn't it? Forget that. We are same human being. Very easy then, communicate.
No.
Reach out. Because we are social animal. Basic sort of emotion, like that. We are same. Same does not mean it's the size of nose. color of hair, or the kasada, thick hair, or less hair, and the shining head. You see, there's a difference. But basically, within that, same emotion, same mind, same intelligence. Same. But I, not same. Your eye, very round.
Yep. Utterly same.
Yes.
Please, go ahead, Arthur.
I think there's another point that's illustrated by Your Holiness. You know, you raised the question concerning the relationship between desire and fear. I think this is called shyness. So, for example, I think many people would desire to meet Your Holiness. And at the same time, I often experience people have fear around you. That there's a nervousness, that there's an anxiety, that there's a certain element of fear. I think any teenage boy knows this when he sees his girlfriend who's not his girlfriend, you know, the one he desires. He desires, and yet he pauses and retreats. So in the moment of desire, there's also the fear. They come together. I don't know if the same system. It sounds like this is actually biologically connected. But I think it's far more prevalent, the arising of fear at the hand of desire, the longing to know Your Holiness, and then the fear that comes back. And that barrier that you described, I think, is somehow that experience, the experience of longing and at the same time fear. So we withdraw. And when you're just perceived as a human being like me, a human being, then that barrier just decreases. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then there's less desire because you're no longer the hero. And at the same time, there's less fear because you're just like me.
I think child... young age, I don't think could they be shy?
So, for example, the child's love for his or her mother, one wouldn't expect that kind of shyness or fear in that.
That, I think, related with intelligence.
Yes.
Getting older, then...
So, because as you get older, you know, more kind of proliferations of thoughts,
you know, anticipations, expectations, and hopes and fears. Yeah.
Oh.
The only time we see this in a child, Your Holiness, in a young child, is with autism. We sometimes see this.
Autism is like the Nazir children. Dearly, and yeah, Susu Pamela is Jimmy, but the young dos. So this is due to the particular condition.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think animal. Also, I think they. I think because biologically, you see, they.
So even in the animal world, because of their biological need, one wouldn't expect fear of their mother.
Right. Yes, that's. I think that's true. Of
course, we're talking about social animals that whose survival and nurturing depends upon mother's care.
Yeah.
In Tibetan, there is an expression, and Izones just use it, which is reto. And we always use it together, hope and fear. Actually, we use it all the time together. So the hope of getting something, the fear of not getting it, once we get, the fear of losing it. So actually, we constantly use those two together. We see someone who has a lot of reto is someone who is keeping on entertaining a lot of expectations and fear. And this sort of flips and comes together, and this is one of the main causes of dissatisfaction, suffering, and so forth. So it's not that surprising that we may find those flipping things also in the brain.
So from the Buddhist point of view, it's understood that those who have a much stronger grasping at their own sense of self, there's a greater sense of self-focus.
Again, it's a self-centered attitude.
And built upon this, you have all these, you know, you become vulnerable to the kind of worldly concerns of praise and insult and so on and so forth, which then builds up this mechanism, psychological attitude of being constantly caught in this cycle of hope and fear. So this is what happens. But on the other hand, if you have an individual who has less grasping at the self-focus, has a greater... So we're not talking about the emptiness point of view, but we're talking about a sense of self. Less self-focus, and someone who has a deep sense of integrity and transparency, then there is less fear. And that person is also more free from this trap of hopes and fears.
So, I think from the Buddhist viewpoint, I think we can say the fear much little with self-centered attitude. Desire, want, not necessary. The desire for because of the peaceful life, the whole world, or others. There's no basis for fear. Fear,
So one would imagine that, for example, a bodhisattva who is dedicated entirely to the well-being of other sentient beings, it would be difficult to imagine such a person having a kind of a...
Who really practice or believe so long space remain, so long sentient being, suffering remain, I will remain in order to serve. There's no basis of fear.
Sure. Yeah. 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 I think that the kind of desire that you're describing in this way, Your Holiness, is very different, I think, than the desire, than the wanting. The wanting and desire that I think Kent was describing is a much more obsessive desire. So that if you, for example... If the desire that Kent was describing, if you had some symbol on your desk that represented the liberation of all sentient beings, if you were so focused on that that you could not do anything else in your day, but just remain focused on that and couldn't engage in other activities, that would be the kind of obsessive concern that would interfere with other pursuits. But this is, I think, a very important distinction because it's a different kind of desire. And I think maybe aspiration or some other term can help us.
His holiness is partly kind of critiquing Matthew's point that Tibetans always use
same
together.
Buddhist, same
it's sort of internal Buddhist,
monk.
Buddhist critique.
No. So it's like I did to Matthew and the
So his holiness is teasing Matthew that you can have hope without the fear element.
Not necessarily always go together.
Well, maybe on this note, mindful of time and your holiness, we need to break for lunch.
Okay.
So thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.